for today, 04AP1208, State v. Beyer. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Beyer is Assistant State Public Defender Donald T. Lang. Mr. Lang.
May it please the Court, Don Lang appearing on behalf of the respondent appellant, Mr. Daryl Beyer. This Chapter 980 case is before the Court on certification from Court of Appeals District 4. The underlying appeal arises from an order finding that there was no probable cause to conduct a trial on the issue of discharge under 980.09(2). At issue today is the remedy to be applied when a circuit court takes so long to arrange for the appointment of counsel in the periodic review process that, in effect, the annual review entitled to a defendant or a respondent under 980.09(2) is effectively nullified.
Can I just ask a fact question? Is it the trial court's delay that is that issue here? Is that the only thing that delayed it or predominantly delayed it?
That is the focus of our concern, is the failure of the trial court to implement the right to counsel and the procedures that follow.
How long did that take?
In this case, it took about 9 months to appoint counsel.
There was a 22-month delay, right?
Yeah, before the ultimate probable cause hearing was 22 months. Much of this is attributable to reasons that neither the court nor the state could control.
You can't blame some of it on people that are deceased, but
no, you can't. Yeah, I mean, there's some circumstances attributable to the original appointed counsel, negligence, perhaps the negligence of the original expert retained who didn't get a report done, and then, of course, finally, the subsequent follow-up expert who passed away during the process.
What about the defendant himself?
To the extent there's any negligence attributable to Mr. Beyer, it's not clear what it is, but at best it's a couple weeks.
Did he not call the public defender's office timely or try and get counsel timely? Was that the problem?
There was a suggestion that he didn't contact them within a week or so after their letter to him. The record was never clarified as to whether he received notice of the need to call or why the circumstances developed that there wasn't a call.
But 9 months for the trial court. Was it always the same trial judge?
Always the same trial court, yes. Yeah, by the time that incident occurred in terms of trying to implement a phone call to Sand Ridge, 8 months had essentially already passed by that point in time.
Well, didn't Mr. Beyer discharge counsel at one point also?
Not in this particular proceeding, no.
That was a different...
That was a different proceeding altogether, yes.
That was the habeas corpus proceeding?
That's correct, yes.
Was there some confusion as to whether or not the same attorney was representing him in both matters?
There wasn't any confusion on Mr. Beyer's part. There apparently may have been confusion on the court's part or someone else's part, or at least the clerk of circuit court may have believed that Attorney Bates, I believe it was representing Mr. Beyer on the discharge proceeding.
So at the at the present time, your client is still a sexual predator who is confined, and the report, there's no suggestion. Your suggestion is that he simply should be discharged.
That's correct. The claim here is that the factual findings at the probable cause hearing were improper.
Now, do you think that are there any other remedies you might think of? Discharge seems to be, this court has seen this case, I think, in various different names on it before, and you think that's realistic?
I think, quite frankly, it is the only remedy that's workable in this situation. Frankly, today I'd like to call the court to issue or announce two remedies. One, for the situation that Mr. Beyer presents, where his right to annual review has, in effect, been violated. And my position is, once the time expires, the annual review is lost, you can't rehabilitate it by simply having a belated probable cause hearing. But I think we've had a recurring problem that this case represents, and that is there's confusion about what's supposed to happen in these discharge proceedings. And I think some of the problem derives from the lack of direction in the statute itself. But whatever the cause, it seems to me there's need for clarification by this court as to what the trial court's responsibilities are once the periodic exam report gets filed with the clerk of the circuit court. And it's basically, I think the court should announce three principles once that happens. The first is, once the report gets filed, the trial court has a responsibility to secure the appointment of counsel as soon as possible. So the as soon as possible language I take from the public defender statute for the determination of indigency. Now, I would propose that that could be a period of like 14 days. I don't think these time limits are magical in any fashion, but it reflects sort of the difficulties that exist in 980s that don't exist in other types of litigation. In Chapter 51s, we routinely provide counsel literally on a moment's notice within 72 hours. 980s are a little more problematic because they require some specialized background to litigate the cases, and so that the pool of attorneys available for the public defender is pretty limited in terms of who can appear in one of these cases. So counsel should be appointed within 14 days absent good cause for some delay. Secondly, the probable cause hearing should be done within 90 days, again, absent good cause or an extension request on the part of the patient. And thirdly, if the probable cause hearing is not conducted within 90 days, and there's not been a finding of good cause for an extension or a request for an extension on the part of the patient, that the matter should be set for a trial on the issue of discharge without any further probable cause intervention. And I think this proposed remedy for future problems in this context has three attributes to it. First of all, it provides incentive for the state and the courts to make sure that the counsel is appointed and the proceedings proceed with dispatch. Because there's going to be a trial, which may not otherwise be necessary, if you don't do the proceedings in a timely fashion. Secondly, it safeguards the patient's rights to have judicial review, because it assures that there will be, in fact, a trial if the rights aren't protected. And thirdly, it addresses the concern that Justice Wilcox's question has, because I think if we have a procedure whereby there's going to be a trial, if you don't timely appoint counsel, we will eliminate this difficulty of having to employ what is a harsh remedy of discharge in the event that the proceedings aren't conducted with dispatch.
Mr. Wang, if we followed your suggestions here, aren't we basically interfering with the role of the legislature? Aren't we writing into the statute all kinds of things that aren't there right now?
And the answer is yes and no. And the way I say that, in Jarrell J. this last term, the court implemented procedures for the taking of confessions. And I think this case is a lot easier for the court to employ its supervisory function, because I think what I'm asking the court to do is so clearly within the core of judicial activity. Essentially, what this court is doing is filling a gap in the statute to address judicial activity, addressing the responsibility of courts to act within the statute. I'd also suggest that it is, in fact, consistent with what the legislature has crafted, that I'm not calling for some provision that subverts the legislative intent. What I propose here would implement that intent. In drafting the statute, the legislature created a scheme whereby the respondents would automatically secure judicial review unless they waive that right. In fact, it's interesting that the legislature made access to the courts so easy. The patient doesn't have to file a petition. He simply doesn't agree to waive that right. And I think it's in recognition of the difficulty of many patients who are mentally ill to really independently implement their right to petition for review.
Well, there are other remedies. The judge has been dilatory in exercising this. I suppose you could report them to the Judicial Commission. Maybe the court or somebody has authority to dock pay for not fulfilling the job. Nothing else?
Well, none of those remedies provide much comfort for the respondent, and most of the respondents aren't in a position to implement those remedies.
You want something that, in effect, gets the Chapter 980 committee what he is entitled to under the statute, namely a prompt review, prompt meaning before the next annual review. Is that the goal?
It's the goal is to complete the process before the next term, yes. And obviously, Mr. Byer's case, because of the delays, that couldn't be accomplished. In terms of future objectives, the ideal is to get the probable cause procedure done early enough so that if the court concludes there's a need for a trial, that procedure as well will be able to be conducted before the end of the year. To defer a probable cause determination until, 11 months later, obviously there's not going to be a trial conducted within the year.
Counselor, but, can't the 980 committee also ask to have a reevaluation? He doesn't have to wait for the annual evaluation. And if he asks for a reevaluation, then how does your suggestion work out?
I guess two responses here. Obviously, my complaint here is that the exam was not done timely.
I understand. So, you want something done with the exam.
Yeah. Under 980.10, theoretically, a defendant can file a petition for discharge, in which case an exam would be ordered. The difficulty with employing that provision, is twofold at least. One is the petitioner has to be aware and able to file the petition in the first instance. Secondly, if he takes that route, pursues that route, and is unsuccessful, there is a penalty in terms of subsequent petitions that are brought by this individual. And this court indicated in Post that utilizing the annual review proceedings, the respondent isn't penalized for a petition that doesn't meet the probable cause standard. That review is going to be guaranteed him, as it is in all civil commitments, on an annual basis. And I guess the question is, to what extent, what's all the fuss about here? And really, the fuss derives from really two components. One is, all civil commitments have a review mechanism. That's what makes them a civil commitment instead of a punishment regime. The need for review in 980s, I think, is a particularly acute because the rapid rate at which the knowledge employed in these proceedings is constantly changing. The determinations of dangerousness change as new research is done. The background for actuaries and things that are commonly used in 980s didn't even exist when the statute was created. So there's constant refinement in the 980 context. So there's really a particularly great need for annual judicial review of these particular commitments.
Mr. Lane, do you think that if there was indeed a violation of your client's rights here, that violation was a statutory violation, was a constitutional or due process violation, or was it both?
It was both. I think the statutes implement what the due process recognizes, and that is the need for regular annual review. It is what this court found in Watts in the 55 context, and I think it applies with equal force here. I think the legislature wisely recognized that that's what was required, and that's why they indeed created this annual review requirement in the first place, is to make this a legitimate civil commitment scheme.
Are there any other states which have not comparable to 980 statutes that do not have annual reviews?
My belief is all of them do. This raises, I guess, another component of the importance of the check and the importance of appointing counsel, in particular at an early stage. I was reviewing the Washington statute yesterday, and what struck me was it's very similar to the Wisconsin statute. I believe we, in fact, followed their provision. But at the probable cause stage, there's two ways in which the defendant or respondent can meet the probable cause standard. And one of them actually puts the onus on the state, that the state has to make a preliminary showing that there's essentially probable cause to believe that he's still a sexually violent person. And then secondarily, the defendant can make an affirmative showing that he may not be a sexually violent person. So you get a trial through two different routes. In Wisconsin, and this is where the right to counsel comes into play, the probable cause hearing at this stage is a very unusual one, because in almost every other context, the finding of probable cause has to be, or the establishment of probable cause is made by the party who bears the ultimate burden of proof. They must show that there's an issue of fact to warrant a trial. In the 980 context, although the state ultimately bears the burden of proof, it is the respondent who actually has to make a probable cause showing to justify getting a hearing. Now, so not only is there an affirmative burden at this stage, unlike most probable cause stage, counsel's role isn't just to sit back and try to claim that the state didn't meet its burden. The defendant, respondent, whatever, has an affirmative obligation to come forward with information in order to entitle him to a trial. And in a 980 context, that's not an easy task, because the nature of the information tends to be highly specialized, both in terms of defining what a mental disorder is, and then in trying to understand what proof of dangerousness may be. In most cases, that means understanding the actuarial instruments. Without the aid of counsel at an early stage, the respondent's not going to be in a position to meet this initial burden.
How about this? How about a rule, if the hearing isn't held within 90 days, within 10 days after the expiration of the 90-day period, that the respondent shall be brought before the court personally to address the immediate scheduling of the probable cause hearing?
That just defers the problem. It seems to me the critical stage here, there's two things that are critical to the 980 review process. One is having the exam done in the first instance, because without the exam, the process doesn't even initiate. It seems to me the second important point is the appointment of counsel, because that's the individual who's going to marshal the evidence for the respondent person.
Well, the same kind of thing. You look at what we did in Marbury, you have different remedies, and you're saying, the remedy is discharge. It's hard to order, not impossible, but it's difficult to order discharge of a person who is still a sexually violent predator. And we can order it in theory as we sit up here in this lovely hearing room with seven justices and gorgeous marble. But when you're a circuit court judge who has to sign the order for release of the sexually violent predator into the community, that's a little tough. So you're saying that's the only remedy. And what I'm trying to come up with is something that curbs the violation so that such a remedy may not be the only avenue of recourse.
And that's why I propose the prospective adoption of an interim remedy that will address the problem, give incentive to the state to act, protect the respondent's rights, but yet not require discharge. For Mr. Byer, that ship has sailed, so to speak. The time to do a timely probable cause review hearing, as he's entitled as a civil committee, as he's required by the statute, that passed. I'm not going to suggest, we should just do this and it's easy. It's hard. And ultimately, it's hard, but the law requires it.
You're analogizing this to a speedy trial.
That's kind of suppression, double jeopardy in terms of mistrials. There's many contexts in the criminal context where we don't look to see if the guy's guilty. If we think he's guilty, we're not going to enforce the law. But if we think he's innocent, maybe we'll enforce the law. If we're not sure, maybe we'll enforce the law. Sometimes the rules have to be enforced. Ultimately, the Constitution protects us from government power. And in this instance, the one safeguard is that the state has to follow its rules, or that we have to enforce the rules. A client of mine in the 980, a number of years back, asked me, "Mr. Lang, doesn't the state have to follow the rules?" And I said, "I think they do. Yeah, we have rules. We're required to enforce them." In this particular context, I don't know that there's a remedy, apart from discharge, that adequately vindicates this right.
If it's like a speedy trial, you can be released from the conditions of bond. So we could say you're released into supervised release in Milwaukee County. That should take care of it.
Assuming they found a placement and the like. I know the state suggests that, well, hey, you can petition for supervised release. Well, there are apples and oranges here. I mean, supervised release is, assuming it's ever implemented, is placement in a semi-secure status in the community. I mean, in effect, it's having a bracelet, not being able to leave the house, but you get to watch TV on your own time more. And perhaps you can go to a job, assuming they'll hire you. It's not at all comparable to discharge. There's a substantial government power that still hangs over you. And to suggest that if the judge doesn't act on your petition for discharge, that what you should do is anticipate that and then ask for a remedy that you don't really want to vindicate your rights seems to me to be an absurd suggestion. The statute guarantees him this right. He sought to implement the right. His right wasn't implemented.
Mr. Lang?
If you don't implement it, it doesn't look like a civil commitment scheme any longer. It looks more like punishment.
Here's the problem, Mr. Lang. The statute, as I understand it, under sub 2, doesn't contemplate a specific time period, correct?
That's correct, yes.
So we have to read into the statute a reasonable period of time. I'm assuming that's your argument.
That's also correct, yes.
All right, so if we have to read into the statute a reasonable period of time, if an individual doesn't get a hearing within a reasonable period of time, I guess I have to ask the question, in terms of remedy, wouldn't a reasonable remedy then be to order an immediate hearing? I mean, if the goal is to get him in to have the hearing, isn't that the remedy?
I think if we were within a year, that might be the remedy.
How can you have that as a remedy if the guy doesn't have an examination and he doesn't have a lawyer?
Well, that is a practical problem, yes.
I'll say.
Yeah, do you have a hearing with no attorney or no preparation makes the hearing a sham, in effect. And I guess that brings me back to my earlier observation that the appointment of counsel is sort of the critical point in this whole process, because it's the lawyer who can protect the client's interests, secure the expert, secure the reports, assure that the proceedings are done in a timely fashion.
I thought we had a case a while back where the issue was that the department wasn't doing timely reports. That is the annual review, right?
That's correct, yes.
So your whole remedy relies on a review, right? That is, that the department does something. The department doesn't do what it's supposed to do, you never get to your remedy. Is that right?
I guess, in my words, I conclude that discharge wasn't the remedy.
I'm trying to, under your future remedy, everything triggers in your suggested remedy on the department doing something.
I'm presuming there will be a report filed with the court.
Okay, a report filed. But we've had cases where they've never filed reports within that year.
I'm sorry.
Are they filing reports annually?
My anecdotal experience is that the department's doing a considerably better job at doing that. I can't say with any certainty that they're always doing it in a timely fashion, but closer.
That was one of the issues in a prior case. Okay.
So maybe you have to start out your remedy by saying that that the court has to have a calendar so that it advises if that report is not filed in a year that there's an order to show cause why it isn't filed.
Absolutely. That would seem to be a logical solution just as a matter of procedure. Ideally, these individuals would be appointed counsel who would stay with them through the whole process, but that's not how it's done. And I think there's assumptions made by circuit courts that these individuals are represented all the time that they're at Sand Ridge. But as soon as the judgment or order is entered, that representation terminates. So ideally, both people would be gauging this to know where the case stood.
Yeah. So you got to get a report timely. Then we have to get a lawyer representing him timely. And then what do we do about an examination? You just say probable cause hearing within 90 days.
Well, presumably if counsel is appointed in a relatively prompt fashion, it's counsel's role then to request, or he may choose not to request an independent report, but it would be then his responsibility to make that request or pursue relief.
Okay.
Now, if he's unable to secure an expert in that time, then he can ask for an extension of that 90 days. That's why I don't make that a written time limit. It seems to me that's the presumptive time to act.
Right. And then you just set a trial, and if the guy can show he's entitled to discharge, you get rid of him. But it's all done by process. That's what you're suggesting.
That's what I'm suggesting, yes. Okay. And that would provide a way to kind of gauge how the proceedings are going and to avoid letting it slip away without counsel being appointed, without the procedure being fulfilled.
I understand that. Thank you, Mr. Lang. Assistant Attorney General Eileen Prey, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good afternoon, and I am Assistant Attorney General Lee Prey, and I do represent the state of Wisconsin. Taking a look at this case, what we're dealing with is a situation where there were no specific statutory violations. We're dealing with a case where the Department of Health and Family Services did nothing wrong, or is claimed to do nothing wrong. The state prosecutor did nothing wrong. This is not a Schulpius, this is not a Marbury situation. We're dealing with a case where Mr. Beyer got a probable cause hearing and he was represented by an attorney in full compliance with 980.092A.
How many weeks, months, years after the
How long did it took 22 months. However, the greatest share of that 22 months was the court attempting to ensure that Mr. Byers was properly represented and that he had access to an independent exam. It was not the court's fault that it took many months for the first attorney to do nothing, and then another attorney was appointed.
How long? When did the court appoint the first attorney? Are you talking about habeas or this proceeding?
No, I'm talking about in this proceeding. At about the six-month mark, Mr. Beyer wrote to the court, informing the court that he didn't want to have Attorney Bates represent him. Attorney Bates had represented him on both a previous discharge proceeding, on his first re-exam, and had represented him on a habeas. I think
was Bates appointed to represent him on this proceeding?
He was not. I think there was some confusion about that.
So 6 months of confusion.
At 6 months, correct. Mr. Beyer wrote to the court informing the court that he wanted to proceed with the discharge, probable cause, and that he wanted a different attorney appointed. At that point, the court sent the letter to both the state prosecutor, one of our persons at DOJ, Juan Colas, and also Attorney Bates. And Juan Colas sent back to the court what we term in our office a Pollock letter explaining to the court what the procedure is once the court gets an 07 exam and there's no waiver that's been signed. And at that point, the court attempted to contact the public defender's office to get representation. There was some problem with Mr. Byers getting back in contact, and an attorney was finally appointed in November, and that's at approximately the 9-month mark from the date of the filing. At that point, according to some lower court precedents there, the court could have decided that it was going to schedule a probable cause hearing that would have been within a year. And there, the court scheduled one a week after receiving the 07 exam, and the court found that it was not ineffective assistance of counsel for the attorney not to ask for more time or to ask for an independent exam. The court chose instead, I think wisely, to ensure that Mr. Byers had appropriate representation and had an independent exam. And in order to do that, the timelines, the hearing became delayed because there were things out of the court's control, such as the first attorney doing nothing, the first expert doing nothing, the second expert dying. I mean, those are things that the court couldn't control, and neither could the state control. So that it's the state's position that, first of all, there certainly were no statutory violations here. Mr. Byer continually argues that there is a requirement for a judicial annual review. It just is not so. It's not anywhere in the statute that is a judicial annual review. Periodic review, yes. And the state agrees that a periodic review is important to uphold the constitutionality of Chapter 980, but there's no specific judicial annual review. And the state also asserts that...
How often is one entitled to a periodic review again?
Excuse me?
How often is one entitled to a periodic review?
Well, there's very many different avenues for review in the statutory scheme of Chapter 980. So, for instance, there's a petition for supervisory release, and once that petition has been filed, there's very strict timelines that are created for appointing an independent examiner and then a hearing after that. Petitions for discharge on the behalf of the secretary, or where the secretary authorizes one, and there's in that case, because in those cases there probably won't be a need for an independent examination because it was probably positive towards the patient, there's a 45-day time limit before the first hearing on that. And there are also avenues for petitions for discharge that are in addition to what we have here is what's usually called a default petition, because it arises once an 07 exam is filed and the patient has not signed the waiver of a hearing. But in addition to that, there's a 980.10, which is a separate petition for discharge that the patient can pursue at the same time or at a different time. So there are a variety of avenues. Each of them have different timelines.
But a person is entitled to a periodic examination at least once every 12 months, correct?
Correct, yes.
And what is the point of a periodic examination if one can't get it reviewed in a reasonable period of time?
The periodic examination forms the basis of two different things. It forms the basis both of the discharge proceeding and the supervisory release proceeding. And it's the purpose of the periodic review is to show whether there's been any change in the person through treatment generally in order to support either supervised release or discharge. It's interesting that Mr. Byer picks up on 07 as the basis for stating that the discharge process has to be done in 1 year, because it also forms the basis for a petition for supervisory release, which has different timelines. And in fact, now the first petition for supervised release that cannot occur until 18 months after commitment. So by definition, there will have been two exams by the date of the first time the person petitions for supervisory release. So I think it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to read in the legislative intent for a annual judicial review in reading together 07 and 09.
After the first 18 months, when is the next time you can petition for supervisory
release? I believe it's 6 months after the last petition has been denied.
Every 6 months?
Well, after it has been denied. I mean, after the process goes through.
All right.
So it wouldn't necessarily be 6 months after the
conclusion of the process.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
What's the matter with Mr. Lang's suggestion that the court put in some timelines for the trial court so that we get prompt reviews and not have this keep coming up? Because this is not the first case, and I bet it's not going to be the last case. Yeah.
Perhaps this is a different case than the cases that this court has seen before. This is not a case such as Marbury where there was a specific statutory directive that was violated. This is not a case such as Schulpius where there was a discharge or supervisory release order by the court, and for whatever reason the department was unable to place them. So it is different. And I'm not sure there has been any evidence that this is a systemic problem. Now, to answer your question, I'm sorry.
Is it a systemic problem? What is happening out there?
I think that the state has done several things to try to prevent this from being a problem. First of all, I do believe that judicial education is strongly advised. I think that's really the route to go, and to inform courts and their clerks that when they get an 07 exam without a waiver, that they should put it on a tickler system or a calendar to schedule a hearing and appoint counsel as soon as feasible. Much of that this judicial education is being done informally by the prosecutors throughout the state who work with their local judges, especially new judges that come into rotations dealing with this kind of case, to let them know that that's the procedure.
Oh, at a given time, the system of the court said that's the procedure. I mean, it would help judicial education if the court said that's the procedure. An 07 without waiver comes in, it's on your ticker.
Right. Yes. You're saying what time limit to put on that?
No, you should do it right away.
Well, as soon as possible. And the other...
So that would fit with what you think should be done now.
In the sense of judicial education, I am certainly opposed to writing that into the statute, that the legislature did not write a time limit in the statute, and they could have. They did in other instances.
Are you opposed to the court writing in as a requirement for the judges?
I oppose to the court imposing a specific time limit, yes.
Just do it informally through judicial education.
Yes, yes. And as another way to make this process go more smoothly, the prosecutors in our office, who are about 40% of the people who do the commitment procedures, they do 40% of the commitment procedures, do now send off what they call a Pollack letter. When the Department of Health and Family Services copies the prosecutors from our office with the 07 exam, and when there's no waiver, they will send a letter to the court saying, "From at this point, the procedure is that you should schedule a hearing and appoint counsel if counsel is not already appointed, and that the patient may want to request an independent exam." I think that letter has gone a great way to solving a lot of the earlier problems. I think it's also important in judicial education, however, to make it clear to the courts that such a letter isn't an ex parte communication, because there's been some claim that perhaps that is. So I think judicial education may be the better route.
Should I have courts say that? court say that when you get in 07, that we advise that the schedule is a hearing, appoint counsel, and that there may a request be an examiner, and if you get a Pollock letter, it's okay?
That would be fine. But I guess what I'm really saying is that probably the better way to go about it is through judicial education instead of having one or the other parties inform the court of what
Don't
the
procedure is. Don't you view judicial opinions as part of judicial education?
Certainly.
Okay.
Yeah. But I still oppose having written into the statute through a court decision specific timelines that aren't there and haven't been shown to be constitutionally
So you
required.
Object to the 14 days?
Yes.
Okay, but you don't object that the to advise the trial court is their responsibility to get counsel as soon as possible?
Correct. And that the way to enforce that is through let me get to a third more informal way and then a way to enforce it.
All right.
A third more proactive. I kind of list these three ways as sort of proactive.
Right.
Judicial education, the Pollock letter. And a third thing, I think there could be better coordination at the public defender's office. There's a great deal of confusion over who is representing this person post-commitment. You've got a person who has the right to an appeal their commitment. Very soon they will have rights to petition for release, to petition for discharge. Many times, in this particular case, Mr. Beyer had an original petition for discharge before any of this happened, and Attorney Bates was representing him. He then brought a habeas petition challenging the timeliness of his first 07 exam. Mr. Bates was representing him. And then in this proceeding, a lot of the materials, I believe, were copied to Mr. Bates, believing that he was still representing him. And I think if it can't be that the same person represents the person all post-commitment, which would be the best result, I think, at least there should be some communication between the attorneys representing the person on differing things and communication back to the public defender's office that this proceeding is going on and this person isn't represented. So I think some coordination at the public defender's office would be appropriate.
Would you object to the court saying then?
No, I don't object to that.
Okay.
Mr. Lane may, but
I'm going to ask him too. Go ahead.
If these proactive measures are not working to get a hearing in a reasonable amount of time, then I think the route of a supervisory writ is appropriate. And I know that...
Let me stop you, if I might, mm-hmm. for just a minute at this point. 22 months seems to me like a very long delay. Let's assume for a minute that that is a violation of the rights of the petitioner in this case. Do you think that that's a statutory violation? Do you think it's a due process or constitutional violation, or both?
Well, I think if you assume that his rights have been affected, I think it's a due process violation, that the delay became so unreasonable that something needed to be done. I believe that you can sort of apply the same sort of framework you do in a speedy trial, although I sort of hesitate to do that because in a speedy trial the person hasn't been convicted as yet, and so they have a much larger liberty interest involved. Here you've got a person who has been committed by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt to be dangerous. But I think by looking at the speedy trial framework is it kind of an interesting framework, which is after about a year, generally, there's a presumed prejudice. But then you go into a case-by-case analysis to really look more closely at what caused the delay. And any delay that was caused by the defendant himself or his counsel is sort of subtracted from the ledger. In this case, three-fourths of the delay was caused by the defendant or his counsel or his experts. And then you also look at whether the person has been asserting his right to a speedy trial, or in this case, asserting his right to proceed with the discharge hearing. And Mr. Byers did, but at that point, the court acted. As soon as Mr. Byers informed him that he wanted a different attorney and that he wanted to proceed, the court did proceed with scheduling, with appointing counsel.
Even then, the delay was from August 26 of 2002 to January of 2004, even after he acted and made the request and said, give me an independent examiner and give me counsel, right, other than Bates?
Correct, but that was because his first attorney did nothing. And his second attorney had difficulty getting an expert who did nothing. And then the second expert died. So that, I mean, that's...
But it's hard to put that blame on the petitioner, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly...
I mean, it's
sort of one of those things that is not possible to do anything about. I mean, it happened. I mean, interestingly enough, there's no ineffective assistance of counsel claim here, and I think the reason for that comes to the fourth criteria in a speedy trial analysis, which is prejudice. There's absolutely no showing here that Mr. Byers was prejudiced. He remains a sexually violent person. If his attorney would have been appointed earlier in the process, they would have found that he remained a sexually violent person. So and under an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, there would be no prejudice. And I think that only makes sense that you do not want to be releasing, discharging people who remain to be sexually violent people. In this case, Mr. Byers is a pedophile who preyed upon young girls, and even his own expert says he is still substantially likely to prey upon young girls in the future if he's discharged.
Again, assuming a violation of his rights here, and assuming that you're correct, there should not be an outright discharge of somebody who is still a sexually violent person, do you have any suggestion as to what the remedy would be in this case, or should be?
I think there's no need for a remedy. I don't think he's been given his discharge hearing. He has been found to not be in any way appropriate for discharge. He has at his ability, if he in the future would participate in treatment, he hasn't to this point, or at least he hadn't up until the point this case was filed, he may be able to have a more favorable 07 evaluation in the future where it will show that his condition has changed, though he's a credible candidate for supervised release or discharge. It's interesting because I think we're talking now about whether the certain procedures are constitutionally required, and Attorney Lange says that, you know, the petitions for supervised release is just a different animal, that you can't say that that's part of the constitutional analysis. Well, I believe in a 97117 context, a person has to be first conditionally released before they can be terminated. So obviously it can't be that it's constitutionally required that you have an actual discharge proceeding in a year.
Well, let's assume that this happens again to some other committee.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the remedies are for that person?
Well, I think, again, you go through an analysis such as a speedy trial analysis, and if there is no prejudice against the person because they are not appropriate for discharge, then the remedy is not to release them. I think it's clearly the remedy is not to release this person. I think hopefully the remedy is that when other proactive measures aren't working, the person has contacted the court and said they wanted to proceed with a discharge hearing and wants appointment and the court does nothing, that the supervisory writ is the appropriate remedy. And I know that Attorney Lange has said, well, there's no club behind the supervisory writ. Not like in Marbury, at least part of the court approved mandamus action with contempt to support that. Well, I mean, it's been my experience, and maybe my experience isn't broad enough, but when an appellate court orders through a supervisory writ a circuit court to do something, I think very rarely is that totally ignored.
You're talking about something like mandamus, right?
Like mandamus, yeah, yeah. And which was, if you look at, it's in my brief, RRE, the 971-17 case, where in that case it was the court that had delayed, and the finding of the court was it is not the intent or can we release a dangerous person who's been committed under 971-17 until a court finds that it is safe to do so. And the remedy in that case was a mandamus. I think that, excuse me?
Mandamus to do what?
A mandamus to hold a hearing.
Okay. So let me give a hypothetical that under the statute, as you indicated, doesn't have a time limit for the probable cause here. And I'm going to engage in exaggeration for emphasis, hopefully exaggeration. And it's 88 months a no probable cause hearing is held. Is it your position that even though the statute says shall, that there is no violation of the statute given the 88 months as long as the person continues to be a sexually violent person? Sexually dangerous, I mean.
And the shell that you're talking about is the shell hold a hearing? Is that
the shell that I'm talking about is in 980.09 sub 2. If the person does not affirmatively waive the right to petition, the court shall set a probable cause hearing. Determine. That's what I'm talking about. That's okay. The shell.
Mm-hmm. I think there's no statutory violation.
That's right. Well, that's what you're saying. But 88 months,
I think,
can
you go through? I'm sorry.
88 months and still sexually violent. Can there ever be a violation
of the statute?
Yes.
No.
Can there ever be a violation of the constitutional right?
There can be a due process violation.
And then that's the remedy.
And that's where you go into the reasonable, whether the time was reasonable under the situation.
And if not, what's the remedy? Because I hear you saying that there is no remedy of there's no, as long as a person is sexually violent, that in essence there's no remedy.
Never have to hold a probable cause hearing as long as
there's no prejudice.
Mm-hmm. They will. The remedy is being ordered by an appellate court to hold a probable cause hearing. Because
remedy the 88 months. I think that's the question that Justice Bradley is asking.
I suppose if a person were, because of this, even though it wasn't the fault of the state for holding them, that they may have some kind of damage proceeding for the time that they were held beyond the time when they were no longer dangerous or mentally disordered.
Okay, but my hypothetical indicates they still are a sexually violent person.
I'm sorry.
So, yeah.
In that case, there's no need for a remedy.
Well, but if the statute provides you're entitled to a hearing,
mm-hmm.
and you don't ever give them a hearing, just because the next report says the same thing, that he's violent, the statute is being totally undermined.
And that's the situation where the appellate court orders the circuit court to hold a hearing. And they
88 months later.
Well, hopefully that would not happen. But
okay. The question is, I guess, you know, so interesting about the law. It depends on focus. What's your right here? Do you have a right to a reasonably timely hearing?
I think that's a really good point, because from my perspective, the right we're dealing with, the substantive due process right we're dealing with, is not to be held beyond a time when you are no longer dangerous and no longer mentally disordered. And in order to validate that right, in order to ensure that that right is not violated, you need to have procedures set forth. So periodic review procedures to ensure that a person isn't held beyond the time when they no longer are dangerous and no longer mentally disordered. But that is the right.
And Ms. Prey, to follow up on that, if that is the right, that is a legal determination, not a medical determination, correct?
Correct.
So to have a legal determination, that has to take place in a court, does it not?
Well, it doesn't really. I mean, I don't know in this case whether we would find, you do this Matthew versus Eldridge balancing test of the liberty interest involved and the administrative burden, the chance of an incorrect result, and you decide, you find out, for instance, in the case of psychotropic medications, which is a very severe kind of enforcement on people either 971-17 or in prison, it has been found that, no, you don't have to have a judicial determination to determine that. You can have an independent administrative determination. So it's not necessarily true that you need a judicial determination, and not necessarily that it has to be annual. Just because a certain legislature enacts certain procedures to protect this procedural due process, to protect the substantive due process right, doesn't mean that those procedures are constitutionally required. It has to be sufficient to protect those persons who are no longer appropriate for commitment, and that those cases will be heard so that they won't be held.
But my question is, how do we know if the person is no longer a candidate for commitment until the court rules upon it? How do we know that?
There needs to be periodic examination. I absolutely agree that there needs to be periodic
But that deals with the report. The statute deals with the report. My question once again focuses on the determination. How... Your argument seems to presume that there's no prejudice as long as the person is dangerous. How do we know if the person is dangerous until they get a judicial ruling?
Absolutely. It has to be either a judicial or an independent person making that determination. And that's why you won't know that the person is still dangerous until somebody makes it. That's why there has to be a supervisory writ if it becomes overly long to enforce some sort of judicial or, in this case it's judicial because that's what the statute requires, judicial determination.
As a matter of practice, are these reports being done annually and timely?
As far as I know, I haven't checked recently, but as far as I know, I'm not aware of.
And what about?
I know they've done a great deal of work to become timely.
What about a court appointment of counsel on filing of the report in response to your Pollack letter?
I'm not aware of a systemic problem. I'm just not aware that there is one. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Prey. Mr. Lang?
I guess as a preliminary matter, it's obvious we have a very different view of the statute itself, because I think there's both a statutory violation, and I also think there is a guaranteed right of judicial review, which the state seems to question. And like the Court of Appeals below, I don't think you read 9807 and 98092 independently. They work together to create this periodic review process. You are guaranteed review, you can waive it, but you are guaranteed judicial review every year. Essentially, the state's position is, well, you get this right to review, but we don't really have to give it to you in any kind of timely fashion, as long as eventually we can conduct a hearing, and at that hearing that we eventually conduct, you fail to meet the probable cause standard.
Mr. Lane, do you think there's a systemic problem? In other words, opposing counsel And I think she sort of hesitated to say that there was or what. Is there a problem out there? Is this something that's happening?
I feel a little uncomfortable because this is obviously outside the record, and I can only go mostly by anecdotal, but my understanding, it's a tremendous problem, and I can't believe over the last decade how many people have called me without a clue of how this is supposed to operate. I've had a number of dealings with Jefferson County where they seem to be right on top of things and are quickly appointing counsel. And thankfully, it's staff counsel that's involved from the public defender, so she's familiar with the client, so procedures move swiftly. But in other instances, these things tend to sit in a file without any action for prolonged periods of time.
So you don't, you know that in the county you're familiar with, it's timely, but you hear worse stories.
Well, I've dealt with a number of counties, and there tends to be big gaps in time before the process gets
right.
Would you object if the court says your public defender office sort of better coordinate so that everybody knows who represents them post-commitment?
Yeah. Well, there are multiple procedural difficulties with this. One is so many of the people that are represented by private bar counsel.
But if
the appointments don't last into perpetuity, and there will be a gap in time from the date of the initial commitment to the date that there's eventually a review. In fact, there may not be a review for a considerable period of time because the first time around, the patient may, in fact, waive the right. So maybe a number of years down the road before something happens. My practice, because this problem has occurred, is when I represent somebody, I give them standard letters to send to the court when their periodic exam time comes so they can alert the court that I've had an exam, I want to have an attorney and an expert, and here's my request, and it's, you know, just with their signature to fill in the bottom. Absent that, I don't know how many of these individuals would have gotten lost in the shuffle. Stephen Phillips in my office told me he's working on a case on appeal, and there's been a new round by the time these things tend to get litigated. And essentially there was a five-month gap from the filing of a periodic exam report and an order he received appointing counsel. And the miraculous thing is the court took the step of appointing counsel for the person, even though an attorney has not yet been appointed. So that's sort of an odd situation. But still, we had a five-month gap in time. In terms of comparing to speedy trial and the prejudice requirement, I think the nature of the comparison just doesn't work because this is a civil commitment. It is an awesome power that the state uses when it bases its confinement of a citizen not on an act they did, but on predictions of what they might do. We control that power by having regular review to make sure that the authority is contingent upon continuing mental disorder and dangerousness. Procedure is critical in civil commitments, far more so than time limits in a criminal case. It is the enforcement of the time limit that is critical. As Justice Butler suggested, the department cannot know, the trial court cannot know, no one can know whether this person continues to meet the standard until they do the hearing. If the time passes before you do the hearing, you may indeed be violating the situation where they should have been released earlier, but you never got to the hearing. What is the protection here? The protection is against the government continuing to confine you without your commitment being reviewed. That's the interest that's being protected. Interestingly, there's a reference to involuntary meds. In this court, in Anthony DB concluded that involuntary medication orders in these 980 cases should expire if they're not renewed every year. There's a recognition that this kind of intrusion upon an individual requires annual judicial intervention. And certainly, being confined at all is a greater intervention than compared to just the medication component. I see my time's up, so again, I request the court to adopt both the remedy of discharge for Mr. Beyer because his right to periodic review was in fact nullified, and likewise adopt procedures that will prevent this from happening in the future, because ultimately we all benefit if this situation is resolved in an expeditious manner. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. Thank you, Ms. Bray, for another argument relating to the enforcement of Chapter 980. That concludes our hearing in 04-AP-1208, State v. Beyer. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45 for additional oral arguments, and the court will meet in conference at 3:10.